Today I'm going to talk about India. Although I was not born in India, I've spent most of this life in India. I first came to India in 1976, and at that time it was unimaginable how India in 1976, that's 24 plus 22, almost 50 years, has transformed from being a, I guess you could say, backward country into a nascent world power. India's changed a lot. It's standard in journalism from the West to present India in a bad light. BBC comes to mind. They may not even know that they're doing it, because journalism, it's people who generate it, and people have their preconceived notions. The BBC makes a big thing about being neutral, unbiased reporting, but they're not. And on speaking from this side, India side, it seems to be they're always poking at India. As a matter of fact, they're always poking at Russia. Well, now, they're not just poking at Russia and poking at China. And some idea that we, the British, we are the exemplars and the definitive form of civilization. And others who are not up to the mark that we set, they're not really civilized. It's a leftover from colonialism. But actually, it's all part of the idea that I'm better than you. It's not a very high level of consciousness. Especially, they like to denigrate countries that they perceive as a threat. It's not only the BBC, but it's just BBC comes out of America also. And of course, it's a mixed bag. But there's no doubt a mixed bag means it's not that every journalist and every publication, and even on the BBC, every report is anti-India. But even then, even the so-called pro-India ones, they're like condescending. That's my perception. So they mostly focus on countries that are perceived as a threat. And what threat is India to the UK or the Western world in general? What threat has it ever been? And what threat is it now? Militarily? No. Economically? No. But there is a threat. It's a cultural threat. India's culture and spiritual knowledge is incomparable. And if you leave aside all the innuendo, then actually the spiritual culture and the depth of philosophy that has been there in India far exceeds, well, it just makes this what goes on in the West seem like baby talk, actually, because they have no idea, actually, of what spirituality is. No idea. They don't know the ABC of spiritual knowledge, that we are eternal living beings, we transmigrate from body to body to body. And without that, all the philosophy you may propose, it's all built on a it's just like in mathematics, you can get up to very high levels of mathematics, but if you get your basic arithmetic wrong, everything's going to be wrong. 2x plus 5x equals 3x. Or you may do very complicated equations. X squared minus 2c divided by 7.5 well, you wouldn't have 7b multiplied by the square root of 7d. But if you get your basic arithmetic, you may be able to handle the complexity of the algebra, but if you get your arithmetic wrong, it's all going to be wrong. Actually, India is unique in terms of spiritual knowledge. I mean, every country is unique in its own way, but still, India is unique in as much as it, culturally, it's unique. You can say there are other countries in the area which are similar, but the culture that's going on in India, plus the size of India and the diversity of India, there's no doubt India's unique country. And for that matter, China's unique, Russia's unique. But some countries are more unique than others. The difference between Luxembourg and Slovenia is not going to be as much as that between Russia and China, for instance. Anyway, these are all general statements. I'm talking here about systemic dislike of India and denigration of India. In one sense, it's a backhanded compliment that in the Western world, they keep on harping on about the rapes, the land of rape in India, although by statistics, it shows that India is very low in rape compared to most other countries in the world. Talking about casteism, riots, as if there are no riots anywhere else, women's issues, discrimination against Muslims, and on and on and on. If there's a riot in the West, it's an aberration. If it happens in India, well, what do you expect? They're all savages. That's the general kind of attitude that comes over as if there are no social problems in the West. The West has got enough of its social problems that they have to interfere in other countries and point fingers at them. You clean up your own house first. Anyway, the Western press is especially against India having a strong patriotic government. Why is that? Again, it's perceived threat. They don't want anyone and standing up and saying, hey, look, you should listen to us. They like governments that are weak. It may not be consciously that they're doing this, but it's the ingrained animalistic consciousness of one dog barks at another. Who can bark the loudest? Now, in human society, it's much more sophisticated, the way the barking goes on, but it's basically the same thing. And what to speak of in the West, even the English, especially the English medium press in India, it harps on the same issues and often misrepresents them. There's a reason for that, is because it's outlined in that book, Breaking India, by Rajiv Malhotra and Neelakantham. Sorry, I don't remember the full name just now. How promising English medium journalistic students are taken to America to study. And then they get ingrained with all this stuff. And then they come back to India and denigrate India from inside. Now, I'm not saying there are no problems in India. Definitely are. There are problems. But the attitude toward it, that there's something basically wrong with India's whole outlook on life, and we have to shape ourselves according to what comes from the West, that is, from my perspective, reprehensible. And you may ask, well, why am I talking about all these things? I'm supposed to be talking about spiritual things. I'll get to that. Now, I'll start to talk about that. Even among our devotees of Krishna in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, And it's probably the same in other Veda-based or Sanatan Dharma-based groups that have followers in the West. But even many Western devotees, they mouth the same blab about India, land of rape, casteism, and all this kind of thing. They get their understanding of India from a large extent from their conditioned mentality, which is shaped by the mass media. It seems to me they may be reading and forming their opinions more from, I don't know, Fox News or CNN or BBC or the New York Times or whatever, than from Shastra, from studying Srila Prabhupada's books, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. But also, devotees who come to India, it's starting again after all the lockdowns, they see the conditions compared to the West. It may often seem to be disorganized, and definitely there are cultural differences, but because there are cultural differences doesn't mean that the way people do and act and do things and in India is necessarily worse than what you're used to. There may be culture shock also. The heat often gets to people from the West. Sickness, it's not as bad as it used to be. I mean, there used to be a lot more prevalence of sickness among Western devotees coming to India. Among Indians in India, it used to be standard that anyone coming from the West, within 3 days, they'd get dysentery, and then they'd get malaria, and maybe typhoid. I never got typhoid. I got dysentery and malaria and other things. Of course, you do get sick in the West also, but somehow or other, the kind of disease that you're not used to, it seems to psych people more. And for many Westerners, India just seems too austere. And again, it's not the same as it used to be. It used to be more difficult. In the days when conditions in India were not so materially developed as they are. It used to be that many devotees of our ISKCON used to come to India with the idea of doing service and staying in India, but they soon returned. Actually, in 1977, I thought I should go to India I was in London, in the ISKCON temple, but I was having severe health problems, largely caused by the climate, rheumatoid arthritis at a young age, which was very painful and really inhibited my service. So I thought, I have to go to a hot climate. Let me go to India. That's what I thought. It's the best place for spiritual life. My GBC at the time, the overseer of activities of ISKCON in London at the time, Jayatirtha Prabhu, he gave permission, and I was almost ready to go. I had my plane ticket booked, and he phoned me. He took the trouble of phoning me. I really appreciate it. It's very, very personal, even though he was so big and I was so small. He phoned me up and said, "Look, so many devotees go to India. They spend so much money on plane fare with the idea of going and staying there. And they come back within just a short time and say, oh, I can't take it. It's too hard. And they just waste time, money, energy." He said, "Are you going to go to India? Stay there." So I did. I said, okay, I'm going to stay there. And it was hard and it was difficult in so many ways. But largely thanks to that advice from Jayatirtha Prabhu, I had made up my mind, okay, I'm going to stay. Whatever happens, I'm going to stay. And I also remember, this must have been, I guess it must have been around Gaura Purnima time. approximately this time of year, and that would have been 1978. And at that time, I would have been in India about 7 months. And I remember sitting on the terrace roof of ISKCON Center in Calcutta, speaking to Basu Ghosh Prabhu, who I just knew slightly at the time. Of course, I know him very well now, who had already been in India for several years. And he made the comment at that time, and he probably doesn't remember it. He said that, oh, now you've been here enough time that you are an India devotee. You're, in other words, a devotee who's come from the West and is in India and is part of the Indian ISKCON scene. I'd made it. I was not going to run back quickly. I was there. So I remember that. And yeah, it was austere, but I used to think, actually, the first summer I was in Bangladesh, which was the summer of 1979, I learned later it was the hottest summer in 40 years, and I was traveling in the villages and no electricity, and no electricity means no electric fans and air conditioning, no question whatsoever. So it was extremely hot. But I thought that, well, I'm not the only one here. There are millions of people in Bangladesh and India and surrounding countries are experiencing the same heat. So they live in it. I can live in it too. So I went through with it. I remember once in Bangladesh, I was in a village and there was an Australian devotee about the same age as me, a young brahmachari. And you know, you go to the tube well and pump water in the bucket and take a bath, and he was just looking at me and said, I can't believe all the austerities you're undertaking. It's so austere, taking baths with a bucket as a way to pump the water out of the well. So what? What's the big thing? And if you're in Australia, you'd turn the faucet and the water comes out in a shower, and here you'd pump, 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 and then what's the big thing? But he seemed to think it was, oh, tremendous austerity. In Bangladesh, we went through many difficulties in the beginning in many ways. I remember Bumna Prabhu from Canada, he was there. He used to come and go. He was based in India, but he used to come and go for service. And he commented once, because in Dhaka, in the city in Dhaka, it wasn't as austere in the villages. So we used to get powdered milk, which is imported from Holland and Denmark, and make that into yogurt. And you could make it quite thick. And he commented once that, oh, the biggest sense gratification around here is thick powdered milk yogurt. It's about the only sense gratification. And two devotees almost literally went crazy. They just couldn't handle it. One devotee from America was trying, he was completely rattled by the phone service, and you could tell all kinds of jokes and stories, but it wasn't much of a joke when you're trying to call, and he was trying to phone his mother or something in America, and it was just such an austerity to try and make a phone call to. He almost literally, he broke down in tears and he couldn't take it and he had to leave. Another devotee, godbrother of mine from Germany, he came to Bangladesh and he actually started to go crazy. He was just talking, looking into the distance, talking nonsense, not talking to anyone in particular. And he was going more and more crazy. And I had to just quickly get a plane ticket for him and me, because I had to accompany him, get a visa for him at short notice for India, and I took him back to India on Janmashtami. I had to do all this because I couldn't keep him. He's just going crazy. I had to take him out. Later, when I said this to Jayapitaka Maharaj, he said, look, India is hard enough, but Bangladesh is much more difficult. I didn't think of it at the time, but of course that was the early 1980s. Things have changed, but it seems that, yeah, in general, Western devotees don't adjust very well to India or Bangladesh. They find some do. Mathura Prabhu was there for a short time until he got sick. Then he went back to the West. Otherwise, he was having a great time. he liked it. But the point that you find it hard to adjust to a place doesn't mean that you blame it or that you think it's something wrong with it. My disciple Vishnu Chitta Prabhu in Atlanta, he commented to me, he's from India and from a middle-class city background, so he's not having the same background of austerities that people have in the villages. But nowadays in the villages in India, it's nothing like it was before. There's electricity, there's TVs, not that I watch TV, and all kinds of things. So anyway, he commented to me that it's hard to make Americans into brahmacharis as we know them in India, as we know brahmacharis in India, because they're used to such comfort. And he told me that in Georgia, the state, yeah, Atlanta is in Georgia, the state of Georgia in the USA, that if you have a residential building, it's mandatory to have air conditioning. Because I was saying, I don't have air conditioning. What do you have air conditioning for? He said, no, you have to by law. How are you going to make brahmacharis into brahmacharis? Everything is geared for comfort. Of course, brahmachari is a state of mind, but we also hear from Shastra that brahmacharya and tapasa, they go together. Austerity. Years ago, I was visiting a farm in America, devotee farm, and devotees were telling me, I went to their house. They said, oh yeah, we're just living very simply. And this is simple. This is, maybe it was simple by American standards, but by Indian standards, it didn't look at all simple to me. Even in America, they have combine harvesters with air conditioning. So you're sitting inside air conditioning. Just as an aside, it's not really on the topic, that it seems to me that Indians who go to the West adjust much better than Westerners who go to India, as in general, maybe because the culture in the West is so materialistic, and Indians, modern Indians, are very interested in materialism. That may be one reason. It may be one reason also that mostly they know English before they go. So they hear people talking all around them and they don't get spooked out by people all around them talking in languages that they don't understand. Anyway, we shouldn't think the point here I'm making, and it's aimed at Western devotees, that you just consider the West, materially it has advantages. Spiritually it has many drawbacks. It's culturally the pits. In the West, practically the best you can hope for is to be tolerated for being a devotee. Whereas in India, you're respected for being a devotee in general. And Western devotees, they shouldn't disparage India even for the spiritual reason that this is the land of Krishna. This is the land of Rama. This is the land of Ganga, Yamuna, Namada, Kaveri. This is the land of our culture, the culture we have chosen to adopt. This is the sacred land. I'm going to read I'm going to read from my own writings. It's my own writing. This is referring back to the 1970s, that by conventional understanding, India's influence in world affairs was trifling in comparison with that of America. But in terms of spiritual significance, India is unique within the whole universe. Now I'm going to quote from Harishori Prabhu's Transcendental Diary, Volume 1, Chapter 9, in which it's related that an American disciple said to Srila Prabhupada, "Your American disciples are beginning to appreciate India. When we first arrived, we could not understand why you were so busy here, but now we see that India is the most important place on the planet." Srila Prabhupada replied, "It is the most important place in the universe." This is, of course, substantiated in the Shastra. For instance, you can check out Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 19, Text 23. In the whole universe, this place is the most important because Eta Brahmanda Bhari Ananta Jibagon Chaurashi Lokha Jonite Koraye Brahman. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes that there are unlimited numbers of living beings in the universe and they transmigrate from body to body within 8,400,000 species of life. So some are born in the heavenly planets, some are born in the hellish planets, and there are 14 planetary systems. And within all this vast cosmos, this land, Bharatavarsha, which is conventionally understood to mean the land which is politically known as India, although previously it encompassed what is now known as Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, parts of Afghanistan, and even wider, but the core area is from Sindhu Pradesh, Sindh, and somewhat west, and then over to the border, we could say, with Burma. And that's also Bangladesh, Thailand, Siam, Shamadesh. So this was all within the broader India. That's why I say Indonesia. Yeah. It was all related. Anyway, this land is the most important in the universe because people are born in different places according to their karma and how they have to carry forward their karma and their desires in the next life. Those who are ready for spiritual advancement are sent to this land to operate within the Varnashram system so that they can gradually make further spiritual progress, which is why Krishna comes here, Rama comes here, Ganga comes here, which means Shiva is there. It's a whole spiritual ethos within this land in particular. And of course, it's not that everyone in India is a saint. So many great demons came here also. But basically, this is the most important place in the universe for spiritual advancement. And the most important thing, or the only important thing in the universe, is spiritual advancement. And yes, it's dirty. That's a fact. The cities tend to be dirty. There is a Swachh Bharat Abhiyan, a clean India movement, supposed to be going on, but it'll take time to clean up the place. Yes, civic cleanliness is not up to the standard that it should be. Although, if you go on Oxford Street in London, the prime street in the pride of the British Empire. Whoops, they lost it. It's not empire anymore, is it? Oh, okay. Of the British Commonwealth, of Britain, of England, of London, Oxford Street. If you go at 4 o'clock in the morning, strewn with litter. They have a good cleanup system, I guess. Anyway, India is dirty and that should be rectified, but criticism of India will not please Srila Prabhupada. Or the spirit of, let's be more precise, the spirit of denigrating India will not please Srila Prabhupada. From 1973 to 1977, when ISKCON first started to really flourish and the book distribution really picked up, a lot of money was coming in from the book distribution, Srila Prabhupada took large amounts of that money from America and put it into India for making projects here, temples. He put his own time, most of his time, into India. So he was no longer mostly in the West. He was mostly in India. He used to go outside for world tours, but he was based in India. You can know where a person's heart is, where they put their time and their energy and their money. Several times I've heard that Srila Prabhupada said, my Guru Maharaj ordered me to preach in the West, but he said, I've done that, and my own desire is to preach in India. So he did both. Here is a quote from the book Life with the Perfect Master, written by Satsarup Das Goswami, in which he recalls a period of time in the 1970s in which he served as the personal secretary of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. He was in Calcutta. This is an anecdote from Calcutta in which he, on the order, Satsarup Das Goswami, on the order of Srila Prabhupada, was sent to see how Srila Prabhupada's sister would cook in the kitchen in ISKCON, Calcutta, because Srila Prabhupada wanted Satsarup Maharaj to learn how to cook like Srila Prabhupada's sister. She was an excellent cook. Okay. Satsarup Maharaj recalls, during the course of my lessons, I was sometimes bewildered by conditions in the kitchen. Actually, there was no kitchen per se. I remember it's developed as a kitchen now, but in those days, it was just a room that happened to be there. And as he will describe, it wasn't set up as a kitchen. There was no kitchen per se, no separate room with a sink or cooking range, only a small place in the rear of the temple building with a bucket of flaming coals for cooking. See, there was no piped gas. You bring in a bucket of coals. You don't see it so much nowadays, but still, yeah. There's a bucket with a little rectangle taken out at the bottom by which you can, and it's filled up with coal, and then the rectangle at the cutout at the bottom, you can stoke the fire and it's filled with coal and it's set on fire, and that is the stove. Bucket of flaming coals for cooking and a bucket of water for washing pots. So there was no water no running water for washing pots. Actually, washing pots, that would be done separately. There was very little water in the temple, actually. In Calcutta temple. You would come for a short time every day, low pressure, and that was it. Washing sabjis, things like that. So, bucket of water for washing pots. And the methods of Indian cooking was totally strange to me. They did everything in a simple, non-mechanized fashion. Simple, non-mechanized fashion. Notice that word, non-mechanized. It's unimaginable in Indian kitchens nowadays. The mixie is absolutely essential in Indian cooking, but in those days, non-mechanized. And he gave the example of cutting vegetables while squatting on the floor. You squat on the floor and you put one foot on the knife. It's a different kind of knife altogether in which you cut the vegetables like this. It's actually very, once you know how to do it, because I learned how to do it. I'm out of practice completely, but you can cut the vegetables very quickly and with less strain on, like they're very, very quick, very simple, and very efficient actually, once you know how to do it. But you squat down on the floor, which you can't imagine cooking in the West, squatting down on the floor. Actually in India, everything used to be, so many things were done. The carpenter would have hardly any tools. He'd sit on the floor and put his foot on a piece of wood to hold it. And then he'd make tremendous woodwork just squatting on the floor with a few very simple tools. Simple. Anyway, Satsuru Maharaj continues, the shortage of space created a chaotic situation. Well, in his mind, it was chaotic. In the mind of the people there, it was just normal, that's all. Anyway, going on, Bengali ladies came in and out on errands and workers moved around the kitchen on business unrelated to Prabhupada's lunch, because that's all he was interested in. Satsuru Maharaj was interested in Prabhupada's lunch, when there are other people doing other things. Understanding neither Bengali nor Hindi, and it was not very likely that Hindi was spoken in the kitchen there at that time, although he wouldn't know the difference between Bengali or Hindi anyway. Understanding neither Bengali nor Hindi, I usually couldn't tell what people were doing, and I worried that the lunch would be delayed. Pishima seemed to be delaying also, catching her attention and pointing to my watch. Made no impression on her. I had to stand by and observe without any hope of changing things. The idea that, well, they're doing everything wrong. And I can't do anything to change it. It's a very disempowering feeling. You can't take charge of the situation. Okay, we're Americans and we're going to do things properly here. But you can't communicate to the people. And even if you could speak their language, then they wouldn't be interested in changing, most probably. And actually, I did learn the language, Bengali. And when you learn the language, you can speak to the people and you can get to understand them better. And then you can understand better, well, maybe they don't need changing. Maybe I need to change. Anyway, he said, without any hope of changing things, even when I saw something I thought wasn't up to Prabhupada's standard, something about the use of water bewildered me. And in one of my entries into Prabhupada's room, I made a derogatory remark for which I paid dearly. My tone was not flippant, but again, anxiety-filled. I thought I should inform him of the strange things going on, as if Srila Prabhupada wasn't familiar with the goings-on in what to Satsuru Maharaj seemed very strange, but what was just a normal Bengali cooking scene. Now, I'm not saying this to denigrate Satsuru Maharaj, but I'm just giving a commentary on what he himself is stating. Srila Prabhupada, I began, you say that the Indian culture is shuchi, cleaner than America, which is mlecha, but it appears to me that the kitchen here is dirty, and certainly by American standards, it might appear to be disorganized and dirty and this and that. You mind your own business, Prabhupada said sharply. His words were like a slap and immediately brought me to my senses. There was no need for more discussion. I left his room and hurried back to the kitchen to get his lunch, realizing that I had fallen into mundane, pro-Western fault-finding. Why had I allowed myself to get unnecessarily worked up just because of some cultural differences? Prabhupada wasn't concerned, so why should I be? I remembered running to him in confusion about how to handle guests. He had told me, everything is all right. I know, I went through the same thing that Satsuru Maharaj went, but I came out the other end. When you see the guests are coming and they're just behaving in a way that you can't relate to, and what do I do, Prabhupada? And Prabhupada said, it's okay, everything is okay. Everything is all right. Now he, Prabhupada, had said the same thing in a different way. Mind your own business. Don't get on the mental plane of rejection and acceptance about temporary things. Don't identify with the body and mind thinking I am an American. Just mind your own business, serve your spiritual master, and don't worry. So there's some pertinent advice. And of course, Indians shouldn't think, well, I'm an Indian and therefore I'm superior. That's also nonsense. It is a great opportunity, no doubt, to be born in India and to take up this spiritual culture, Krishna consciousness. If you're born in India and you don't take up Krishna consciousness, then you're nowhere. If you're born in anywhere else and you do take up Krishna consciousness, then your life is blessed and glorious. But the point here, this mundane consciousness of finding fault with India, it's very much part of the Western psyche. And like I said, it's not just India, but Russia is bad, China is bad. Nowadays they're more careful about it, but there is that consciousness. Growing up, I remember we'd make jokes about the French and the Italians and the Irish, although I was from a semi-Irish background myself, and bad words about Pakistanis and black people, and it was always just as if somehow we must be superior because we're British. And there were things, I remember seeing one comedy show on TV, Marty Feldman, and he wouldn't be allowed nowadays. It was because there was talk how the Chinese, they're breeding so much and they're going to overwhelm us with their population. And then they showed, they made a spoof of a baby is born every second in China, a new baby is born. And they showed an insulting looking picture of a Chinese woman, a real caricature of a Chinese woman, with a baby popping out of her every, stomach blowing up and a baby popping out every second. So we don't want to get involved in this, especially with India. We could make offenses by considering everything Indian bad. We should be above the bodily platform and at the same time understand that this land of India in all the universe is dear to Krishna. He appears here. Is dear to Rama. All our acharyas up to the present time have appeared here. The culture here is the nearest approximation to the culture of the spiritual world, which we're supposed to be cultivating ourselves. There are faults due to the influence of Kali Yuga, no doubt. But Krishna consciousness is founded in Vedic culture. And Indian culture or Hindu culture is founded in Vedic culture. So much of the cultural background of India is very much pertinent to Krishna consciousness. Now I could get into another whole subject. In the spiritual world, they're not wearing blue jeans. Women wear saris. I could get into a whole big thing here, but that's for another talk. I've given talks on this before. But anyway, we say the same things again and again. But really, this land is worshipable for us, especially the places that are connected with Krishna and Rama and with Shiva and Durga, and yeah, they're also worship. You think we should? Lord Shiva comes. We're not going to worship him because we're centered on Krishna. Durga, temples of Durga. We're not going to worship Durga because we're devotees of Krishna, or Krishna himself worships Durga, doesn't he? The gopis worship her. Now, that doesn't mean we systematically do so, but these are all worshipable personalities for us. Here's another anecdote. This goes way back, before Bhakti Raghav Maharaj accepted sannyas. I believe it must be early 1980s. And someone asked him. At that time, he was based out of Mayapur, and he used to travel around West Bengal, as he was the pioneer of the Namahatta program in West Bengal. He was the leader, and with him was Gauranga Prem Das Brahmachari, who's been leading the program for years since then. So he was pioneering that program. He used to go everywhere barefoot. And someone asked him, why do you go everywhere barefoot? And he said, well, it's just like if you go in a temple, you go barefoot out of respect. So for me, I see all of Bengal as sacred because this is the land of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And actually that's stated by Narottam Das. Sri Gaura Mandala Bhumi Jeba Jane Chintamani Tar Hoy Braja Bhume Bash. Narottam Das says, whoever sees the land of West Bengal, the pastime places of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, whoever sees that as fully spiritual, such a person actually lives in Vrindavan, in the spiritual world. So there's so many holy places in India. I don't think it's not possible to even know them all. So many pastime places. You go anywhere all over the country, there's so many pastime places of the Lord and his various avatars, and many of them they may not be recorded in Shastra, but they're known to the local people, and there are temples just like in Salem, and just at the edge of Salem city, there's Ayodhya Patanam, one it's become a suburb of Salem now. So that there's a temple of Lord Ram there. Lord Ram visited there, so we're told by the local people. We have no reason to doubt. He must have visited so many places. They're not all recorded in Shastra. So like that, there are holy places everywhere. And Rama walked on this land. He covered so many places. The acharyas have covered so many places. Even there may be so many devotees have performed devotional service here. They may not all be famous devotees, but it all adds to the sanctity of this land. So please don't denigrate that. Make the West also pure and holy by spreading Krishna consciousness. As Srila Prabhupada once said, make the whole world India. Hare Krishna. All glories to His Divine Grace. Srila Prabhupada, who kindly left the transcendental wonderland of Vrindavan, left the holy land of India, and came alone among the white aborigines, the barbarians of the Western world, to bring the land of Vrindavan, the culture of the spiritual world, to us who had no idea of this, who were caught in the dualities of thinking we are best, others are just low class. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Vancha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindubhyavacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Dante nidhaya chunakang padayo nipatya kritva chaka kushatameta daham bravimi. He sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat goranga chandra charane. Kurutanurangaha parivadatu jano yata tatava nanumokaro navayang vichara yamaha. Hari rasa madira madati matta bhuvi vilutami. Bhuvi vilutama nartama niravishama. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare.